AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
In today's episode, we turn to London in the winter of 1952, a city that prided itself on its resilience, its stoicism, and its capacity to endure whatever the century hurled at it. This was, after all, the capital that had survived the Blitz, that had walked through firestorms and rubble with a stiff upper lip. And yet, in early December of that year, London found itself confronted not by bombs or blockouts, but by something far quieter, far more insidious, and far more deadly. A poisonous cloud that seemed straight out of science fiction. It began as calamities often do, without warning. Welcome to History Unpacked. If you enjoy the content, consider subscribing. We post every week, and we welcome any feedback. By the first days of December, a cold snap had settled over southern England. Temperatures dropped sharply. Frost gripped rooftops and pavements. Londoners, accustomed to bitter winters, did what they always did. They lit fires. Coal fires, millions of them, crackled in hearths and stoves across the metropolis, pouring smoke into the frigid air. Factories and power stations joined in, belching thick plumes of exhaust to keep the post-war nation running. And above the city, a stagnant column of air hung like an invisible lid. This, meteorologists later explained, was the phenomenon known as an anticyclone, a temperature inversion in which warm air sits above cold air near the surface, forming a trap from which nothing can escape. Smoke rises, cools, and falls back, drifting helplessly at street level. Under ordinary circumstances, London might have endured such a spell with mere inconvenience. But the coal being burned that winter was not ordinary coal. Britain, still recovering from wartime shortages, relied increasingly on cheaper, low-grade oil, often referred to by Londoners as nutty slack. It burned poorly, produced excessive soot, and emitted a sulfur-laden smoke that stung the nose and clung to clothing. When mixed with the city's existing pollution, the result was a toxic broth waiting for a catalyst. That catalyst arrived on the 5th of December, 1952. Fog was nothing new to London. Indeed, the city has built entire artistic traditions upon it. Victorian writers describe London fog with colourful adjectives: pea super, London particular, or the yellow gloom. Painters, too, captured its ghostly silhouettes drifting through the gaslit streets. Londoners walked through fog with a certain pride, as if the very atmosphere belonged uniquely to them. But the fog that descended on 5th of December possessed none of the familiar romance. There was something heavier, darker, and more acrid about it. By mid-morning, visibility within the city centre had shrunk to a few yards. Motorists crept forward at walking pace. Buses, lacking any clear view beyond their windscreens, were forced to halt altogether. The fog insinuated itself into shops, bank halls, church naves. It seeped through cracks beneath doorways. People in their homes found themselves enveloped, as though a phantom had drifted through their walls. Residents described the air as sharp, oily, and suffocating. It clung to skin and hair. It irritated the eyes. It tasted faintly bitter on the tongue. Yet even then, many Londoners shrugged it off. Fog was fog, after all, another inconvenience in a long list of urban annoyances. And then it grew worse. By nightfall, the smog had thickened into something almost tangible, street lights created halos that illuminated nothing. Headlights were rendered useless, glowing like coins pressed against damp cloth. Theatres and cinemas unable to keep the haze from filling their halls cancelled performances. Ambulances crawled blindly through the streets, often forced to stop and wait for a guide to walk before them with a torch, even though torchlight struggled to pierce the murk. Across the Thames, the great landmarks of London vanished from sight. St Paul's Cathedral dissolved into shadow. Big Ben's clock face became a dim blur. Trains stalled at stations, their drivers unsure of where the tracks ahead. Meanwhile, at the city's hospitals, something more troubling began to unfold. Admissions rose steadily, not for injuries, but for breathing difficulties. Elderly patients arrived wheezing, clutching their chests. Children coughed violently. Those with asthma, bronchitis, or heart conditions deteriorated rapidly. Doctors, puzzled at first, soon realized a grim truth. The air itself had turned deadly. For beneath the fog lay a lethal combination of sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and microscopic particles, collectively forming sulfuric acid aerosol that coated lungs like a corrosive mist. Yet even then, authorities hesitated. Britain had lived through war. Londoners were hardy folk. Surely the fog would lift by morning. Morning came, and the smog remained. Saturday, 6th of December, brought no wind. The anticyclone tightened its grip. Streets once bustling with weekend crowds fell eerily quiet. Shops struggled to open, milk deliveries halted, funerals were delayed because hearses could not navigate the streets. At Smithfield Market, cattlemen walked their livestock through the haze, unable to see the animals' heads at the end of the rope. Bus inspectors stood at junctions, listening for the faint growl of engines, before signalling drivers to proceed. Some pedestrians held onto railings or building walls, tracing their routes by touch rather than sight. But the most distressing scenes unfolded in hospitals across the city. Respiratory wards filled beyond capacity. The sheer number of cases overwhelmed staff. In some instances, patients died before they could even be examined. Mortuaries began to run out of space. Every hour the toll climbed higher, and still the fog showed no sign of lifting. By Sunday, 7th of December, the Great Smog had become a national crisis. Though official statements remained guarded. Newspapers reported difficult conditions, heavy fog, and inconvenience, but few grasped the extent of the catastrophe. To many citizens, this was simply an unusually dense fog, unpleasant but temporary. It was on this day that the first eyewitness accounts began to surface. Stories of bus passengers collapsing, of horses coughing fits so violent they toppled over, of children who could not walk outdoors without choking. Midwives struggled to reach mothers in labour. On one tragic occasion, a man fell into the Thames because he could not see the water's edge. Yet the full scale of tragedy only became clear in hindsight. At the time, hospitals recorded deaths as resulting from pneumonia or bronchitis or cardiac failure, without linking them to the air itself. But in truth, almost every hour that passed brought new victims. On Monday, 8th of December, the smog reached its catastrophic crescendo. Visibility in some districts dropped to mere inches. People recounted the eerie sensation of walking through a thick yellow wool, each breath shallow, each step uncertain. Cyclists dismounted, fearing collisions with unseen obstacles. Even London's police directed traffic by voice alone, shouting into the haze. It is said that on that final day, London felt more like a city abandoned by twilight itself, a metropolis suspended in a grey-brown twilight, waiting for a rescue that would not come from men, machines, or medicine, but from the sky. On Tuesday, 9th of December, winds at last swept across the southern England, a gentle stirring at first, barely perceptible, then a slow dispersal as the smog thinned, drifted and lifted into the winter sky. With astonishing speed, the city began to reappear. Streets gained shape, buildings regained colour, faces became visible once again. London breathed. But as the haze dissipated, it left behind a silence, and heavy with grim accounting. Only then did the full tragedy reveal itself. In the immediate aftermath, the government estimated around 4,000 deaths. already a staggering figure for a five-day period. But further research conducted in the years that followed pushed the estimate far higher. By some calculations, 12,000 Londoners may have perished directly or indirectly because of the smog. Tens of thousands more suffered long-term respiratory damage. The dead were not confined to any single district or class. They came from the East End and the West End, from polished neighbourhoods to working-class terraces. Infants, the elderly, and those with pre-existing conditions suffered the most. Hospitals later noted that many victims had inhaled particulate matter so thick that their airways were coated in a black, tar-like residue. The Great Smog was not merely a weather event. It was a public health disaster of historic proportions, one of the worst environmental crises to ever strike Britain. In Parliament, questions mounted quickly. How could such a calamity occur within the heart of a modern nation? Why had there been no warning? And why had the government, hesitant to disturb public order, downplayed the severity until the crisis had passed? Scientists, led by the brilliant Harold Devoy and others, emphasised what environmentalists had long argued. London's air was poisoned. For decades, coal smoke had been tolerated as a necessary evil, part of the character of the city. But the Great Smog laid bare the consequences of such complacency. Investigations concluded that the combination of domestic coal fires, industrial emissions, stagnant weather and low-grade fuel had created a perfect storm. Deaths were not acts of fate, but of policy. The tragedy demanded reform. Out of grief came resolve. The Great Smog forced Britain to rethink its relationship with the air that sustained it. In 1956, after years of debate, Parliament passed the Clean Air Act, a landmark piece of legislation that restricted smokestack emissions, encouraged smokeless fuels, and established smoke control zones across London and other cities. It marked a turning point not only in environmental policy, but in public consciousness. Air pollution was no longer an unavoidable side effect of progress, it was a preventable hazard. London's skyline slowly changed. The thick black plumes that once defined the city faded. Chimneys fell silent, industry modernised. And though the city would face other environmental challenges in the decades to come, the Great Smog remained a reference point, a warning and a reminder. Today, the photographs of December 1952 possess an uncanny quality. Figures half swallowed in shadow, trams gliding through yellow mist, policemen guiding pedestrians through the gloom. They resemble scenes from a dream, or perhaps a nightmare. But behind each image lies the weight of real suffering and real loss. What makes the event especially haunting is its silence. There were no explosions, no flood, and no collapsed buildings. The enemy was invisible. Londoners went about their lives unaware that their every breath carried danger. There was no dramatic moment, no singular catastrophe, instead a slow and steady suffocation.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.